irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Get Yourself the Job with Jennifer Hill, only on LA Talk Radio.
Well, happy Monday, everybody, and thank you so much for tuning in to Get Yourself the Job with Jennifer Hill. Before we dive into today's show, as always, we want to thank our sponsors, the people over at Markham Search. Markham Search is an executive search and staffing company with offices on the East and West Coast, providing legal and corporate and accounting staffing solutions for corporations and law firms around the country. And today we have with us on the show, Alan Gannett. Alan is the founder and CEO of TrackMaven, a marketing analytics platform whose clients have included Microsoft, Marriott, Saks Fifth Avenue, Home Depot, Aetna, Honda, and GE. He has been on the 30 Under 30 list for both Inc. and Forbes, and he is a contributor for FastCompany.com. And today we're going to be talking about his new book, The Creative Curve, How Anyone Can Achieve Moments of Creative Genius, published by Currency, a division of Penguin Random House. He was also once a very pitiful runner-up on Wheel of Fortune. So thank you so much for joining us today, Alan.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so tell me a little bit about this. You know, when you were growing up and a kid, was it your dream to one day be a CEO of your own marketing company or to be an entrepreneur?
Oh my God, I don't know. I mean, I always was doing stuff. You know, my parents were divorced when I was really young. I was an only child, and so I think I had a lot of time by myself, and so I think I just generally was pretty self-reliant. So I was always doing things by or with myself, and so I think that sort of naturally turned into projects, which turned into businesses. So that always been my sort of my bent.
And so how did you wind up coming up with TrackMaven, and tell our listeners a little bit about the company and how long it's been around for?
Yeah, so TrackMaven is a six-year-old, 60-person company in Washington, D.C. that works with a lot of big consumer brands, as you've heard of, to help figure out what are the patterns in their marketing data, what are the stories they should be telling people, what are the themes. And the company started because before that I was a marketer, and I was constantly faced with this problem of how do you turn data into insights, right? How do you make data actionable? And at the time, especially, there just wasn't good tools and technology out there. So the product came about out of an own itch I had, which I always think is ideal because you have a good perspective of what the customer's needs are.
That's wonderful. And how did you come? Tell us a little bit about your latest book. So The Creative Curve, what does it mean to have moments of creative genius? Tell me a little bit about that.
So basically, the book is all about this question of whether or not you can learn to be more creative. One thing I realized is that, you know, we have this notion of creativity in our culture as this fixed asset. So, you know, been working with marketers for years, and one of the things I found was that, you know, when it comes to marketing, we think about it and we're like, oh well, you know, people sort of say, well, I'm not that creative. I can't do that. That's not me. And I got really frustrated with this because the reality is that no, you actually can become more creative, and there's tons of science that shows us how it works and how to get better at it. And it's actually a very well-researched thing. And so the big gap between, I think, people's perception around creativity and reality got me angry.
And so tell me a little bit about how does one begin? I'm one of those people where I often have conversations. If I'm at a dinner party, I'll say, you know what? I'm just not that creative. You know, you see people out there who write books and who produce shows or acting or musicians. And to me, I feel like we kind of have people boxed in as like, that's what creative looks like in society. Would you agree? Like, can you tell me a little bit about how somebody like me, maybe, sorry, I asked you three questions at once, but how somebody like me first would begin to really tap into the creativity that I don't feel like is present?
Yeah. So one of the things when you think about creativity, there's sort of two things you want to think about. There's creative potential and there's creative achievement. So let's tackle them both separately. So creative potential is actually really interesting because it's actually pretty well studied. I mean, they do these studies, what they find is that, well, the vast majority of people have actually the same creative potential. And it's not actually about you know, things like IQ, for example. There's been, you know, famous studies that have tracked, you know, kids with high IQs throughout their entire lives and found that they're not actually, you know, there's no real world-class names that come out of there. There's the famous studies in the 90s that found that 86% of kindergartners test at creative genius levels of creative potential, right? So there's this gap between potential and achievement. We know that as humans, creative potential is within all of us. And I think the thing that people sort of get messed up is that there's a lot of conditioning that goes on in childhood to push us away from creativity. Like, you know, you might have heard a parent say, oh, don't be get an English degree, you'll become a barista. And that's a weird thing to say to a kid because it sort of says a whole bunch of strange things about values and priorities, right? Like money's super important. You know, you shouldn't do things that you care about, right? And so we have our entire education system is really oriented towards getting kids to get into high skill, but pretty routine jobs, you know, things that are very repeatable. And these are also jobs that AI and automation are really going to take over the next 50 years. So yes, there's a lot of jobs out there that pay well, that are high skilled, but a lot of those things are also pretty repeatable. And so getting more people to be creative, I don't think just think is a sort of nice to have. I think it's a need to have. And when you talk about getting people to be more creative, well, one of the things you can do is you'll look at the people who have been creative and successful. And so for the book, I interviewed 25 creative achievers. So this is everyone from, you know, I interviewed Patrick and Paul, the songwriting duo who did Dear Evan Hansen, the lyrics of La La Land, and The Greatest Showman. I interviewed David Rubenstein, the billionaire. I interviewed Alexis O'Hanlon, the founder of Reddit, Brenda Chapman, the first woman to win the Oscar for Best Animated Film. She was the director of Brave and the story editor for Lion King. And what you find when you interview these creatives is you're not actually finding the story of random luck, random moments of inspiration. You know, instead, what you find is you find an intense amount of thoughtful hard work, not just hard work. That's also a misnomer. It's thoughtful hard work. It's systematic hard work. And I go into a lot of the details in the book, but the thing that was so striking to me is that these people who are achievers, I almost find it kind of offensive. This notion that they just sort of lucked into it. And I always think it's funny in sports, you know, we talk about, you know, Kobe or LeBron or these people who have all this natural talent, but you talk to their teammates, those are guys who also are the ones who practice the most. They also work the hardest. I don't think that's actually a coincidence. So a lot of times these people who are big achievers find it kind of a little, you know, irksome that we just chalk up their success to, you know, winning the genetic lottery.
I know. And I think it's almost like, not to say a victim mentality, but almost, because if you have a mentality that this person's creative and they were born that way, and therefore I will never be able to be that, it almost gives you an out. So that way you don't have to be responsible for the creative genius that you might potentially possess.
Oh, totally. I also think it's something that, you know, we all kind of like, I think, secretly like that idea of an excuse, right? The idea that like, oh, I don't actually have to like, you know, I don't actually want to do that work. You know, if it's easy for that person, well, I think there's actually one of the dangerous things when you talk about finding your passion. I often interpret finding your passion as find something that's easy for you the first time you do it.
Mm.
And there's nothing that's that. Like the only thing that's that is video games. Like most people we view as creative achievers, the things that seemed so easy to them. Well, they started when they were 3 or 4. And so the hard parts, they were forced through by a helicopter parent. They don't even remember the hard parts at this point. And so I think we just have these sort of faulty notions around creativity that are kind of silly.
Yeah, it's funny that we're having this conversation. One of my greatest mentors is Arthur Joseph, who's a vocal coach. And I think I'd had him on the show last September, and he was coaching me last week. And he said to me, Jen, he said, you need to work at it. If you look at the best speakers, you look at whether it's Tony Robbins or the most successful actor or actress or whomever it is, they work hard. It's not something that they roll out of bed and their voice just sounds a certain way, or the most famous singers. And he told me to go watch a movie, which I watched over the weekend, called White Nights. It was like an 80s movie with Mikhail Baryshnikov, the famous ballerina. And he said, Jen, go watch. It's a good Russian spy movie, but he said, go watch that movie. And if you watch like the dedication and the perseverance, like you see art or somebody who's creative, like a ballerina or an artist, And you just think, oh, they just get out of bed and they're just naturally that good. Mm-hmm. And you just don't think of the hundreds, if not thousands of hours that go into making somebody great. So how do you get yourself to be that disciplined? Say somebody tuning in today says, you know, Jen or Alan, I have all these great ideas, but I just don't have a coach or I don't have a mentor to push me. How can somebody create that level of discipline in their own lives to really make creativity or whatever it is a priority for themselves?
So I think one of the reasons why children are so good at developing creative talent is because you have parents who can, you know, coerce children both by telling them what to do, by applying conditional love, which is a very common story of a lot of creative achievers. Just think about like the Michael Jackson, his father, for example, you know, Mozart, his father, there's a heavy element of conditional love there. So I think as adults, you know, the question is, how do we force them? You don't have the helicopter parent, you know, looking over us. And I think one of the things that is super effective is public accountability. And so one of the stories I tell in the book is of this guy, Jonathan Hardesty, who at the age of 22 decided he wanted to become a fine artist, a fine painter. And he decided he never painted before, like seriously, like he wasn't any good. And he decided that, well, he wanted to become a fine artist. And to do this, what he did is he started a thread on the art message board and said, I'm going to post a painting every single day until I'm great. And he did that for 13 years. It's actually one of the sort of most comprehensive records we have of someone's progression through talent development. In the book, I reproduce one of his first couple paintings with one of the later ones. And it's amazing. And now he's this world-class teacher who teaches lots of people. His art fetches five figures. And you see this transformation. And so I think that public accountability element is so important. And with the internet today, we have so many more tools and resources to be able to do that. And a lot of times that's these days, you know, sort of sharing the journey is almost a form of marketing. So you get, you know, multiple benefits in one.
Yeah, I think that's a great idea because having an accountability buddy, whether it's somebody, a social media friend or just real friends, one of the techniques I know I was made familiar with many years ago is to speak what it is you're up to. Because even if you're having a casual dinner conversation with somebody, and sometimes your people have fears. To be a human is to have fears and doubts and worries. And so we don't want to say, oh, I'm going to write this book, or I'm going to go paint this weekend, or work on a script, or take an acting class, because then we're afraid somebody might judge us if we don't do it. But that what really happens is when you speak about it and you have people who are accountability buddies, or you even just talk about it at a dinner party, that people have the chance to then follow up with you and say, oh, Alan, how's that new book going? How'd that interview go? And then next thing you know, you have people to help hold you accountable for it.
And I'm afraid there's also the karma side of, you know, just as you push on the universe, stuff pushes back. So as people know you're working on something, they say, oh, well, I actually have this uncle who, you know, is in that field. Do you want to meet him? Or, you know, my sister is actually really big in that industry. You know, can I help you connect you? Right. And so you find that being public with your goals and ambitions actually provides a lot of usefulness. And one of the things I talk about in the book is, you know, with creativity, we also tend to mistake this idea of sort of technical skill with timing. And creativity is actually both. To be viewed as creative in our culture, you have to both be technically skilled, but you also have to have the right idea at the right time. Right? I can't just throw paint on a canvas today and make a sort of pseudo Jackson Pollock, and people won't think it's creative, even though it looks very similar, right? Because that idea has been done before. And so one of the things that's been a lot of time in the book is really talking about dissecting this idea of timing, because I actually think that timing is something you can learn. I talk about how, but I think it's something you can learn, much like learning the technical skill of art. And you find the best creators, what they're able to do is three things. They're able to master the technical skill. Two, they're able to master the timing. And three, they're able to market and promote themselves. They're able to get the word out. They're able to communicate with other people about their art, right? Creativity at the end of the day is a social construct. The things we deem creative as a culture, we all agree are creative. There is no objective label of creativity. There's an objective label of something as technically proficient, something as technically impressive, but that is different than something being creative. And so that nuance is actually super important, and that really underlies a lot of the misunderstanding around creativity, that people view it as just the technical skill, but really what they're thinking of there is sort of skill and productivity, but they're not thinking about is the timing and the social dynamics around creativity.
So can you expand a little bit about timing? Because I think it's an interesting concept of, striking the iron while it's hot and just being there and being the first to market. How do you finesse timing?
So it's actually not, it's not about being the first to market. So this is where it gets really cool. So basically, when we think about timing and human preference and what drives people to like certain things and dislike other things, it seems kind of like magical, like you have to have like an intuition for it. But the reality is that science is actually a pretty good understanding of this. And it comes down to, as humans, we have two contradictory preferences. On one side, as humans, we like things that are familiar. They make us feel safe. We actually are scared of the unfamiliar. Our body has learned that unfamiliar things can be risky. They can harm us. They, if you went into a cave as a cave dweller you've never been in before, you might die. We don't want to do that. But then you also have this other urge. You also, as humans, are wired to seek out the novel, the new. We like new restaurants, new experiences. And this is because when we were hunter-gatherers, we were looking for the next meal, the next source of calories, reward, food, pleasure. And so these two urges, the pursuit of the familiar and the pursuit of the novel, seem contradictory. But the result is that the ideas that we tend to be attracted to are actually the ideas that are a blend of the familiar and the novel. They're familiar enough to feel safe, but yet novel enough to still be interesting. And what this means is you see that the ideas that take hold in our culture tend not to be radically novel, right? Harry Potter is the most straightforward orphan story of all time, but they're wizards. The iPod was a better MP3 player. The iPhone was an iPod with a phone. The iPad was an iPhone without a phone. Star Wars was a Western in space. So what you find is that successful creative products are actually much more incremental. Obviously, it seems with music, as styles change, people feature other musicians, they sample other music. Familiarity is the sort of the forgotten child in the creativity family. Familiarity, creating that connection with an audience, creating relatability, creating nostalgia, whatever it is, that's the overlooked aspect of creativity. We focus too much on creating something radically new.
Got it. So it sounds like what you're saying, so as this relates to timing, I'm trying to piece this all together because you're giving so much great information, is that, you have to have some work hard at whatever the skill is and then figure out the timing. So you're saying, because I think I had said bring the product to market. So I want to be clear. Is it always a good time, or how do you know if it's a good time? So say that you're Steve Jobs and you're like, oh, I've noticed there's a gap in the market and I'm going to turn this thing, this MP3 player, into something called an iPod. How did Steve Jobs, or how would anybody know?
Yeah, so this is a great question. So I think there's a couple key things. So in the book, there's two things I talk about I think are really valuable. So one is that you find these great creative achievers tend to be massive consumers of the creative product in their niche. So we have there's this sort of mythology that creators and consumers are in opposition to each other. Like there's that social media meme that's really annoying. That's like, 90% of people consume, 9% engage, 1% create, #hustle. And it's like, it's just stupid, but it's also wrong because actually one of the things I found is the most successful creatives are obsessed by knowing everything in their market, everything in their field, everything in their artistic genre. See, that's part of how they nail the timing. They have to know what's out there. Balancing familiarity, novelty is important, and you better have a really good understanding of what your audience is being exposed to. And in fact, you probably want to be a little bit ahead of them. So that's one thing, consumption, rabid, highly specialized consumption. Two, the second thing is you find that these creators, because they understand that creativity is not just technical skill, but it's also creating something that people will recognize, that people will appreciate, they understand that part of their job is that relationship with the audience. So what they do is that early and often in their process, they incorporate either qualitative or quantitative feedback about their creative product to help understand where it is on that creative curve, where it is on that tension between the familiar and the novel. So in the book, I talk about Ben and Jerry's, the ice cream company, but you probably could call them a flavor company. And I spent a day with the flavor R&D team there. which is like the best job in America. And by the way, it's really weird because like they're all skinny, which I find very, you know, this is a conspiracy
afoot. That doesn't make sense.
yeah, exactly. And what's interesting though is that, you know, they have the people who do their professional jobs. They've been doing this for a long time. You think they just come up with these zany flavors, but actually what they do is they spend about 8 months of the year literally oftentimes consuming food trends, like going to restaurants, going to bars, going to stores, reading magazines, going on social media these days, seeing what's out there. And then they create a list of 200 ideas for flavors they think are that right intersection of the familiar and the novel. They just write them down. They don't actually create them. And then what they do, they split up the list and they send it out as an email survey. And they literally ask people two questions for each flavor idea. One, how familiar is it? And two, how novel is it? Which is basically, you know, how likely to buy it and how unique it is. And the thing they found is that they don't actually just want flavors that people say they want to buy or say are very familiar, because then you just end up with caramel cookie crunch. Even though there's high purchase intent, there's not enough uniqueness for the Ben & Jerry's brand. It's not going to be interesting enough to capture attention. So what they're looking for are ideas that are the right blend, that right balance of familiar and novel, of unique and commercially viable. And that's what I thought was so interesting. Across all these creators I interviewed, over and over again, I heard the same thing, that they wanted that feedback from their audience. They didn't want to go off and create and just throw something out there and hope it worked. No. Throughout the process, whether they're musicians or movie producers or whatever it was, they want that feedback early and often.
Yeah, I could see where, I hear what you're saying, because it's funny, as a human being, we do like to feel safe. And, you know, that's why we like things that are stable, stable jobs, stable relationships, stable friends. But then you do want new experiences. And I would have never thought of putting those two things together. So how was it you identified that, Alan? Was it something that you identified out of all these people that you interviewed, was the creative the familiar?
This is the thing. So, you know, the book is split into two halves. So the first half of the book is really overviewing the science and history around creativity. And the second half of the book is four things you can do to become more creative based on the field interviews I did. So what's interesting is, you know, the stuff I just told you about familiar and novelty, we've known that for years. People have been talking about this. I mean, there's, in the 1960s, Peckham's book talks about this. There's been science about this from, you know, Robert Zionk in, you know, the mid-1960s. I mean, this is like not new, but it's very poorly communicated. And we have a very poor understanding of this. And there are some design schools that do a pretty good job of this, but by and large, when it comes to creativity and creative education, we get people to think it's this mystical, magical thing, and, you know, don't do it because you'll become a barista. But we actually know a lot about how it works and how the human mind works, and you can leverage that.
Got it. And so let's say that somebody is out there and they might not have a whole marketing team, and they're sitting at home today and they're like, you know what? I just have this great idea, but I don't have a marketing team or a survey of people like Ben & Jerry's where I could send it out. How could a layperson have a great idea and kind of test the concept for the novel versus the familiar? Is it a good idea to create a survey monkey and test it with your friends and family? Or how do you know if an idea is viable? Because you see so many startups and you see so many people come up with either startup companies creatively, or they go after their passion and they just don't hit the mark. Do you look for external validation, or does it really just go back to the practice and hard work?
No, I mean, it's all the above. You need the practice, but you also need that external validation. So, one of the things I talk about in the book is that there are sources out there that are very low cost, like Google surveys, for example. You can get a nickel response. You can target for certain demographics. There's a website called PickFu, it's a Kung Fu, where you can run really easy surveys against specific audiences, and you can pick those audiences. So you can do, like, you know, business people, small business owners, all that kind of stuff. And so there's the tools out there. Today we live in an age where it's easier than ever to get that external feedback. And I think also that means you don't have an excuse, right? You should be able to early in your process learn, am I on the right track or am I on that wrong track?
And so it's funny that we're talking about this, right? Because obviously the show is called Get Yourself the Job. And I get people who ask me, well, Jennifer, why do you have entrepreneurs on the show or people who are talking about the business side? And I think that human beings kind of have choice. I've noticed talk about the familiar and the comfortable. I think that some people are just more comfortable working for somebody else where they don't have to eat what they kill. And some people that would crush their soul and they would feel like they would shrivel up and die if they did that. So how do you tell if you're one of those people, if you've always been that safety first employee sort of person and you're like, gosh, you know, I think I have it. I think I'm going to, you know, have the gusto and go out there and try out my own venture or go after my dream of being a painter. Do you think that there are different types of personalities that some are more inclined to be successful versus other people who might not be as successful just because of how they're designed as human beings?
So I tend to come from the perspective of a lot of this is nurture and it's pretty deeply ground. So often it's hard to change, although it is possible to change. But I would push back on the premise. Because I think when you're talking about success, we often fall into this trap of viewing success as, you know, sort of making money or doing all this stuff. And that's all a cultural construction. In other cultures, there's different things you view as success. It could be being a good family member, a good friend, someone who has a lot of fun. It could be someone who has a high degree of education, even if they're not commercially successful. So I think what's important ultimately is to try and rid yourself of those social norms and come up with your own conception of success, right? What would make you feel fulfilled? And it's okay if it's not running a company or being a CEO, right? Because what you find is if that's not the thing that's going to fulfill you, well, doing it's just going to make you miserable, right? So I think it's really, really important when you talk about getting the job or starting a company or whatever it is. I think self-awareness is a fundamental skill and the most important skill, and the one that there's actually, you can work on it, right? You can go to therapy, you can read books, you can talk to people, you can be reflective, you can journal. That is something you can get better at. So I think that's actually the building block for a lot of these decisions in our lives.
I think that's great advice. And then we could go on and on. We obviously want people to buy the book, so we'll make sure to tell them before we go off air as far as where people can find it. Were there any other points or any other tips that you had for people as far as how to tap into their own creative genius or anything I didn't ask you about?
Well, one thing, just sort of ripping off the self-awareness piece, one thing I thought was really interesting about these creative achievers is that, you know, we often see this sort of creativity marketing, which is that we put Elon Musk on the cover, we put Steve Jobs on the cover, but we forget that these people have collaborators, right? Elon Musk has rocket scientists, Steve Jobs had Steve Wozniak from day one. He had actually other employees in that garage too. And so one of the things I thought was interesting is that we sort of see this creativity marketing and PR, and we think that's reality. It's not. Because the creative achievers I know, one of the things they're so good at is identifying their weaknesses, the things they're bad at, and finding other people to fill those gaps. In the book, I talk about Patrick and Paul, the songwriting duo, who they've won now 2 Tonys, an Oscar, a Golden Globe. And what's so interesting is they're radically different people, right? They're not collaborators who are the same and they quote unquote gel. They're actually quite different. But that difference is what makes it work because they support each other's weaknesses. And so I think that's just a very, very important thing. And that all comes from self-awareness.
Great advice. I think that self-awareness, it's the cornerstone of so much in life, of just happiness, let alone success or creativity. So I think anything you can do to become more self-aware, from meditation to mindfulness, is just a great tool to have in your belt. So Alan, do tell our listeners, where could we find the book? If people want to find the book, find out more about your digital marketing, about your company and what you do, where would people go?
Yeah, so anywhere books are sold has the book, Amazon, obviously. And then you can check out the book's website, thecreativecurve.com. Trackmaven is trackmaven.com. And my website is alen.xyz.
Awesome, Alan. Well, it's been such a pleasure to have you on the show today. I appreciate all of your insights. And I know I took away a few little pearls of wisdom that you shared with us today that I'll apply in my own life. And I invite everybody to tune in next week. Karen Millen's going to be on the show. We're going to be talking about her new book that's coming out, Karen Mills. And she's been a teacher of mine over Agape and attends that for those of you who might live in the Los Angeles area. That's how I had originally connected with her. So looking forward to having her on the show to speak about her new book. And then if you missed any portion of today's show, as a reminder, it will be available for download on the latalkradio.com website on the Get Yourself the Job page at the bottom of the page in the archive section. Or you can always find the show on iTunes and subscribe or download it, listen at your leisure under Get Yourself the Job on iTunes. So thank you again for joining us today, Alan, and thank you so much to everybody who tuned in today.
You're listening to Get Yourself the Job with Jennifer Hill, only on LA Talk Radio.